Okay. Deep survival. Lawrence Gonzalez, as I described in the blog, is one of my favorite authors. Deep Survival, I think, is an incredibly important, valuable book, so I introduced him on tape. So, Gary, if you could play our wonderful interview with Lawrence Gonzalez. It is my great pleasure to welcome to this Leary Report one of my favorite authors, Lawrence Gonzalez. Lawrence, are you with us?
I'm with you. Thank you.
Lawrence is a very successful author. He's published 12 books. He's written screenplays, short stories, poetry. He's a contributing editor to the National Geographic magazine with a monthly column. His list of magazines that he's been published in is incredible, including Harper's, Rolling Stones, National Geographic, San Francisco Magazine, many others. In 2003, he published a book called Deep Survival, which is, if I had to put together a list of the top 10 reads for the new millennium, Deep Survival would definitely be on it. And he's just published a new book, which I've finished, Everyday Survival. And both books are linked in the blog post supporting the Leary Report, and as you'll hear more during this conversation, they're books I recommend very strongly to you. So, Lawrence, help us understand what is deep survival, and how is it that you became so fascinated with this subject enough to write a best-selling book and now a new book on survival?
Well, deep survival really represents the culmination of my life's work, in a sense, or I suppose both books do, but deep survival was the first time that everything that I had been working on all my life came together in one thing. And I had done all sorts of journalism in my life, and a lot of it was going into dangerous places and doing risky things, and I was fascinated with people who either did things that carried the risk of death or serious injury, or who did things that required a very intense state of mind. For example, I spent quite a lot of time watching a brain surgeon do surgery and talking to her about what she did, because it was so intense. You know, she'd be on her feet for 20 hours and trying to save some little kid's life. And where that came from, I think, originally was from my father. My father, as I discuss in Deep Survival, was a combat pilot in World War II. And he was shot down twice. And the second time he was shot down, he was very nearly killed. Everybody in the plane was killed except him. And he fell 27,000 feet with no parachute. His plane had broken in half, so there was no aerodynamic stability to it. And he lived through that, was taken prisoner by the Nazis, and came out alive and went on to have a career as a scientist and to raise seven boys. I have six brothers. And hearing these stories about him when I was very little, I became fascinated with why one person would survive when others don't, and what qualities went into making up survivors, and also what people were like who took these big risks. So without really being entirely conscious of it throughout my career, I was gravitating toward these kinds of subjects and thinking there must be some scientific explanation. Well, in the late 1990s, I started reading all of the neuroscience that had been sort of percolating along beneath the surface, and began to realize that indeed there were some explanations to be had for how these things work. And so combining the neuroscience and the psychology and a lot of other sources, I began to be able to explain survival, in effect, which is what I attempted to do in Deep Survival.
One of the things you, in Deep Survival, you walk us through survival experiences of a number of different people, and it's extraordinary to me. It's very beautifully written, and you literally become emotionally involved with that. You know, you're literally living through it emotionally. But all of them are wilderness experiences. And so the focus really is on people who are dealing with physical danger in the wilderness, and certainly, you know, more often than not, accidents.
Yes. It's interesting how that evolved, because at the time I was writing for National Geographic Adventure magazine, which is the magazine I'm a contributing editor to. Not the big yellow standard National Geographic, but another magazine they have called Adventure. And I was doing adventures, you know, in the wilderness. And I would come home from these glorious adventures, and I'd write up a piece, and it would be illustrated with beautiful photographs, and I sort of felt guilty about it. And after a while, I told my editor, you know, people are going to see this, and they're going to go out there and try to do these same things, and some of them are going to get hurt. And don't we have an obligation to say to them, hey, kids, you know, this stuff is dangerous, and here's some things you can do to help yourself not get killed out there.
And so is that when you started researching some of these stories?
Yes, it was. It's when I got serious about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the late 90s probably. I had been campaigning for this sort of safety stuff. But, you know, the editors were inclined to say, oh, our advertisers wouldn't like that. We're supposed to make this all look like fun and games, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, and in fact, you know, I knew people who got killed out there, and I kept hammering away at them saying, look, this is really important, and I think our readers would like it. Anyway, I finally got through to them and published the first article I published for them was called The Rules of Survival.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like, you know, I later used it as a proposal for Deep Survival, sort of like the beginning of this stuff. And it won the National Magazine Award for that year. And then I followed it the next year with a piece called, I think it was called The Land of the Lost. It was about the science of being lost.
Uh-huh.
But what scientists know about what happens to you when you get lost, and how people get lost, and how people map their environment and their brains and all of this fascinating stuff. And anyway, I wrote that piece, and the next year it too won the National Magazine Award, and I said, see, people do like this stuff.
One of the things I was, when I read Deep Survival, I was stunned at, part of it is you create an intimacy by really taking us into these, you know, the moment to moment of what somebody's dealing with when they're lost or in the wilderness or they've had a terrible accident and they're really facing very, you know, difficult odds in trying to dig out of it.
Yeah.
And what amazed me was how similar or how much you could draw from it. I've never been in a wilderness survival situation, but I've been in a survival situation, how much you could draw from it for other kinds of survival situations or everyday life. And I think I started recommending it to so many people because one of the, you know, America's going into what appears to be a very difficult period, and yet many of us are terribly spoiled. We haven't had to deal with real danger. We've been protected. And it seemed to me a wonderful book to help people understand and think about how to deal with real risk.
Yeah.
And it had much wider application. And I'm just wondering if that's what inspired you to write Everyday Survival.
Well, no, that's a bit of a different book. To address your point, though, it turns out I do a lot of speaking engagements, and most of the speaking engagements I do are for people who have nothing to do with the wilderness.
Uh-huh.
There are people who see correctly that I use the wilderness as a metaphor for the rest of life. So I give talks to, you know, institutional investors and bankers and business executives and doctors who treat cancer and firefighters and all these people who are not interested in the wilderness per se. They're just interested in these principles that go into
right.
Surviving well and making good decisions and managing risk. So it does have a very broad, it enjoyed a very broad audience out there. When I wrote Everyday Survival, and I have to say, I don't think that's the best title for that book, by the way. But, you know, publishing and marketing being what it is. I had started to think beyond the survival of the individual at that time, which Deep Survival is about, and begun to think more about our survival as a culture or as a species, or as a global community, and how it is that we can be such smart people, such smart creatures, and do such dumb things as we're now doing on this planet. And so the subtitle of Everyday Survival is Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, which I think is okay as a subtitle. And it starts out, it attempts to start out from the individual level, looking at how we make mistakes, and then extrapolate this into the science and analysis of how we're making really, really big mistakes that could completely end our residency here on Earth if we don't get a handle on it. And my theory about this in writing Everyday Survival is, it goes something like this. Like, you wouldn't take your life savings and go into a casino and start gambling if you didn't know the rules of the game you were playing.
Right.
At least if you were smart, you would bother to learn the rules. We in this, certainly in American culture and in lots of advanced, so-called advanced cultures, we behave as if there are no rules. We behave as if we can make up all the rules and do whatever the heck we want.
Right.
So anything we can invent to make our lives easier, you know, any technology we want to use, we think we can just use it with impunity. And the fact is, there are rules in the universe that can't be broken. And most people don't know what they are, and we're breaking them right and left.
Right.
And are attempting to break them right and left. So it's an attempt to show people a different way of looking at their world that will cause them to step back and go, oh, man, you know, I'm running stop signs here, left and right, and I didn't even know it was illegal. Pretty soon I'm going to get a ticket.
Right.
You know, maybe something bad's going to happen. So that was, and so Everyday Survival is much less prescriptive, and it's much more of a scientific book about a way of looking at our world and the things we do in it.
I get the sense when I'm reading it of you kind of wandering around and thinking, you know, why can't everyone see that we need to turn the aircraft carrier? Why? You know, it's kind of you're searching for a logical explanation on why. You know, it's almost like we're lost in the wilderness. We don't even know we're lost in the wilderness,
yeah.
And that we have a problem.
It's right.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And, well, and my older daughter, I mean, another explanation of Everyday Survival, rather, was given to me by my older daughter, Elena, who said, after she read it, said, well, Pop, this is like taking a tour through your brain. I said, oh, yeah, that's kind of what it is.
Well, you know, one of the rules that you put in, that you have these wonderful 12 rules of survival, which is a wonderful kind of summary of what you could draw out of deep survival, and one of them is to be curious.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So you've proved that you you know that you're following your own advice. So let's walk through the 12 rules of survival. I don't know if you remember them off the top of my head, but I have them here, and I think they're wonderful you know, sort of wonderful guideposts for as you said, what the metaphor of the wilderness experience teaches all of us.
Yeah.
So the first is perceive and believe.
Right. Denial is an enemy of the successful survivor. You know, it's surprising how people can ignore what's right in front of them. And I experience this all the time just in daily life, but one of my favorite stories about it, I was driving to California one time, and I was coming over the mountains, and I spent most of the day going up one side of this long, long road, up the mountain, and then spent the next half of the day going down this long road, down this mountain, got to the bottom of this mountain, which was right there, and there was a gas station, and I stopped to get gas, and the guy was putting gas in the car, and I said, what's the name of that mountain? And he said, what mountain? And I thought, wow, that's really interesting that you can make an entire mountain disappear just by not paying attention to it.
Wow.
I think, you know, a lot of us are that way about things that happen in our lives. We can deny what's right before us, which is okay most of the time because the stakes aren't very high. But in a survival situation, it can mean the difference between life and death. And I noticed that in accounts of survivors who are successful, one of the first things they do is they get beyond the denial. The first reaction, you know, you break your leg at 20,000 feet on a mountain in Peru, your reaction is, maybe I just sprained it.
Right.
You know, and so you go beyond that very quickly to, okay, my leg's broken, now what do I do?
I was very struck with your story about almost flying through the storm.
Yeah.
In everyday survival, where what you're saying is we have a model in our head. I'm going on vacation. It's going to be wonderful. I'm going to have fun. And we get stuck on that model and literally can't, you know, we delay perceiving the real risk and the fact that our model is not coming true.
Right. One of the things I talk about in everyday survival is how perception works, and it has to do with decision-making. We normally think of decision-making as, you know, you take in a bunch of information, you analyze it, and you reach a conclusion, and then you do whatever the logical thing is. But that's not really how it works. First of all, we're mostly not taking in information. The way that the brain works, because it's limited in its capacity, is that we create models of things. We create very simplified models in our heads that stand in for the reality. So, for example, if you're looking for your car keys, you don't have to go around the house examining every object to see whether it's your car keys. You can simply scan sort of very quickly across surfaces, and your eye will only stop when it reaches something that's kind of like a car key. And that's because you have in your brain a model stored that matches this. The ideal model, or the easiest model for people to recognize, is the parking symbol for handicapped people. It looks like a person in a wheelchair. We're all familiar with that. But if you look at it carefully, it really doesn't look anything like a person or a wheelchair. It's just some random lines that are close enough to it that it calls up that image for us. So that's how all of our perception works. And it's very easy for us to construct these models, and then we construct behaviors based on these models that I call behavioral scripts, so that we can do things unconsciously and efficiently. Once we're engaged with these models and scripts, we stop seeing.
Right.
We just, you know, everybody knows you can drive 12 blocks without realizing you've gone, you know, you haven't been paying attention.
Right.
Because it's automatic. And that's a very efficient thing, and it's served us well through evolution, but it's also a very dangerous thing.
So step one is to see it as it is and to face it quickly.
Perceive and believe.
Okay, so two is stay calm, use your anger.
Right. When I talk about staying calm, the first thing you have to realize is that you can think of the brain as having two main modes of operation. One is emotional and one is rational. That's an oversimplification, but it works. The more emotional you are, or the more stress you're under, the less you're able to think clearly. So literally, you can't remember the simplest things if you're put under enough stress or into a high enough emotional state. Conversely, the more you're able to think in a stepwise fashion and logically, the lower your stress and emotions will go. So you can balance these things out in an emergency. One of the mechanisms for doing this is using humor. For example, when you laugh about something, especially about yourself, it tends to calm you down. You don't take yourself so seriously. And another thing people do is they take their natural tendency towards being afraid and they turn it into a kind of anger that's a motivator. It's like, you know, to use the example again, you've broken your leg on the mountain and you say, you know, this isn't going to happen to me. I'm going to get around this. I'm angry that this happened, and I'm going to use that anger as a motivator to get me off this mountain. So that's what that means. It's a way of corralling your emotions and helping them to work for you rather than against you.
And does the anger help you deal with your pain?
Yes, it can. High emotional states generally help you deal with pain, but yeah, in my experience, that's true. These people are aware of the pain. They're, you know, it's not like an anesthetic, but they simply accept it as part of what they're doing.
Okay. Well, rule number three is think, analyze, and plan.
This is the logical brain taking over from the emotional brain, and there are many interesting examples of this in history. There was a famous case of the USS Indianapolis ship at the end of World War II, which was torpedoed by the Japanese and sank, and about 900 sailors went into the water. Many survived, many did not, and there's a lot of stories about how each individual person or group behaved, but there was one officer who managed to get himself to a lifeboat, and in the lifeboat he found this group of sailors who were just completely whipped. They had given up. They weren't trying. They were just sitting there pathetically, basically waiting to die, and he got in the boat with them. And he took out his pistol and took it all apart and gave each person a part of the pistol and said, "We're going to clean this gun now," and made them all help him clean the pistol. And it was sort of a pointless exercise because they're in the middle of the ocean. There's nothing they can do with this pistol. But it served to calm them down and give them a direction, sort of goal-oriented behavior. It was organized. And all of these things begin to activate the logical, rational part of the brain and therefore to suppress the emotional side of the brain. And so anytime you're in big trouble, simply having goal-directed action is something that can serve you to calm you down and allow you to go forward. So think, analyze, and plan is what that means. And it also allows you to do the practical work of simply taking stock of what you have to work with and how you're going to work with it.
It's funny, when I was reading some of the different stories, the word I kept hearing is break it down, break it down.
Yeah, right. Break it down, right. Manageable tasks.
Right. Okay, so the number four is take correct, decisive action.
Yes, well, once you've gone through this exercise of using your logical brain, your rational brain, you can get stuck. And it's amazing how stuck you can get and just not do anything. In fact, there are diseases of the brain that are characterized by people making great plans and never doing anything. We probably all know some people like that. So the step of taking action is really important, and in an emergency, it may be necessary for you to actually take risks in order to save yourself. There are numerous examples of this in deep survival. So when I say take correct, decisive action, that means figuring out what the right action is, not just doing anything, which could be characterized as panic, but the right action, and doing it decisively, even when it involves some risk to yourself. And this is, you know, there's examples like this from the World Trade Center where people, you know, got others out and so forth. But we see this all the time. That's the step that gets you moving.
Right. Okay, and this is one I always forget, is celebrate your success.
Right. One of the things about, like you said, you break it down into manageable steps. Once you achieve one of these steps, it's important to acknowledge your success. That does a bunch of important things for you. It makes you feel good, and feeling good is, you know, if you think about these kind of emergency situations, whether it's in the wilderness or whether it's you lost your job or you lost your home or you broke up with your spouse, whatever the emergency is, it's pretty emotionally debilitating at first. I mean, it's a crummy thing and you feel crummy about it. When you celebrate your success, you take a little step toward feeling better. And feeling better is a great motivator. There's an element, there's capacity for joy in higher animals that is a motivator for what we do and therefore for our survival. So when you allow yourself to celebrate your success in one of these small steps, you're promoting your own success at the next step.
Right. And you're thinking of yourself as somebody who's going to be successful, which is so important. Okay, rule number six, be a rescuer, not a victim.
Rule number six is count your blessings.
Really? I'm looking at...
Do I have the right one?
I'm looking at the one that's published on Life Challenges.
Oh, really?
The Center for Living Creatively with Life Challenges.
Well, I'm looking at my book.
Well, you know something?
Go there.
You're the author, so it's rule number six is whatever you say it is.
Rule number six in Deep Survival, I don't know what's on that website, but rule number six on Deep Survival is count your blessings. It says be grateful that you're alive. And this is a universal thing that I find among survivors. If you go back and you read, oh, Viktor Frankl, say, A Man's Search for Meaning, he's wonderful on this subject. He was a Nazi prisoner in the death camps and described how some evenings the prisoners would gather outside and they'd say, come on, come on, you got to see the sunset, it's so beautiful. And they'd stand out, you know, they're there in the midst of this, all this death, starving.
Uh-huh.
And they're standing there just watching the sunset going, wow, it's so beautiful. And that, you know, that connects with another one of the, one of the 12. But this, you know, this count your blessings is a feeling of being able to experience gratitude for, basically for being alive.
Right.
And I find that the best survivors always describe this feeling.
One of my favorite preachers always says, God does not need what you've lost to bless you. So the whole idea is, you know, you take what you have left and you're grateful for it and that helps it to grow.
Yes, exactly. And that you do have something. The seventh one says play. It says sing, play mind games, recite poetry, count anything, do mathematical problems in your head. This is a technique that goes back to ancient times. To occupy the mind is an extremely important thing in many kinds of survival situations. Whether you're going through chemotherapy or you're in a concentration camp, the mind wants to be active. And play is one of the essential features of mammalian behavior. We play from the earliest days of our lives as a way of learning, as a way, once again, of making ourselves feel good, as a way of communicating with others in our community. And so when you're in a survival situation, you need this just as much as you do any other time in your life. And successful survivors always find ways to do something along these lines, to occupy themselves and to make themselves, you know, give themselves strength.
I was once in a very stressful, difficult, in fact, dangerous situation with a team of people. Yeah. And one of our ways of coping it was to decide that, you know, there was no percentage, there was no benefit to this. We were just trying to dig out of a bad hole. And so we decided that the way we'd make money on this, it would someday become a movie. And so everything became part of the movie. And so two people started fighting about who Meg Ryan would play. Would they play, you know, one person or the other? And it became so much fun, you know, sort of making up and inventing the movie and fighting over Meg Ryan that everyone completely forgot their ills, and it was one of the most productive team experiences I've ever had.
Yeah,
but it came through play.
Yeah, exactly. And as I described in Deep Survival, many of these survivors get out by sort of inventing games for themselves, often counting games. Like one fellow, I don't think this is in the book, but one fellow I talked with broke his ankle out in the wilderness and realized that no one was going to come to get him. It was the middle of winter. And he had to scoot along his butt for 4 or 5 miles to get back to where his car was. And it took him days to do it. And he said he did it by doing 100 moves at a time. He would do 100 moves and then rest, and 100 moves and rest. And he said he did each set of, he dedicated each set of 100 moves to something or someone in his life that he loved, which
wow.
is an important thing because I don't even think that I put this in there. I put it in Everyday Survival, not in Deep Survival, but the more socially connected you are, and the more connected to your world you are, the more motivation you have to get back to it. And so, you know, many, many survivors have said to me, well, there I was, I knew I was going to drown, but I thought, you know, I have to see my son again.
Right. So you're living for somebody or for people or other people, something higher than just yourself.
Right, and that was Viktor Frankl's big point in Man's Search for Meaning, that you have to live for something larger than yourself, something outside of yourself. And so that's all part of this this process we're talking about. The eighth element of this, it says, see the beauty. And this goes back to what I was saying about the concentration camps. But survivors are always talking about this ability to, despite pain, despite adversity, to see the beauty around them. And I've heard this from numerous people. One of the chapters in Deep Survival describes Steve Callahan, who was shipwrecked at sea for 76 days in a very small raft. And it was a terrible situation in which he was starving and likely to die, and described sitting there at night covered with saltwater sores, looking up at the heavens, and he called it a view of heaven from a seat in hell. But even then, he was seeing the beauty of his world. And it uplifts you. It gives you a motivation.
The, okay, nine? I'm afraid to say the names of what I think they are.
I can tell you. Nine things. Believe that you will succeed.
This is one of my favorites.
And these people, it's an interesting paradox, which is discussed in 10 as well. But, you know, they may be very well aware, like Steve Callahan was, that the chances of my dying are really high. But I really believe that I'm going to get through this. You know, I believe it so much that I'm going to do the next thing that's in front of me to do, whatever it is, whatever the next little task is, to catch a fish, to catch some rainwater. I'm going to do that because I'm betting on myself. And again, a lot of this is to keep yourself motivated to do the next thing, because you never know who's going to come out alive. It might be
right.
You. And the same is true if you look at business situations, you know, where companies try to start something like, you know, a new technology or something. People always say when they're done and successful, they say, well, looking back on it, if I'd known how hard it was going to be, I would have never done it. But at the time, what they're doing is they're doing the next little step.
Right.
And the next little step, and pretty soon, you know, you've been at it for 10 years and you're successful.
They make ways. In other words, the way isn't apparent, but they make it, and they make it by believing that it's there.
Yeah, and so that they, you know, if they had tried to swallow the task whole, they'd never manage it. But this way allows them to manage it, and behind that is the belief that they will succeed.
So I can't wait for you to explain the sort of how they get over the contradiction in Rule 10.
Well, Rule 10 is surrender. And this helps you in Rule 9, which is believe that you'll succeed. Because once you accept the fact that you're going to die or that you're going to fail...
You don't have to be afraid of it.
You don't have to be afraid of it, exactly. And you can say, well, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? Well, the worst thing that's going to happen, you know, in business, I'm going to lose everything. You know, in the wilderness, well, I'm going to die. And once you get past that, it's much easier to... you know, to take the little steps and to believe that you'll succeed, because, you know, it's no longer something that you have to fear. It's something that you've internalized and digested and taken on and let go of. So it's a paradox, survival by surrender, but it is, in fact, what you find most survivors do. And often it works very well. I know a lady who was diagnosed with lung cancer, and they said, well, you've got 2 months to live, or whatever it was. Well, 6 years later, she's still alive. You know, and she's one of the people I refer to as rule breakers. It's like,
right,
there are some people, I have one of my wife's relatives died recently, and the doctors told her, you have 2 months to live. Well, she died 2 months later. There are people who will do that.
Right, you believe.
Right. And it's belief is a very powerful thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's in Everyday Survival. I use the example of Roger Bannister, who was the first man to run a sub-4-minute mile. Well, before that, they said it can't be done. If you did it, you'd drop dead, blah, blah, blah. Well, he did it. After decades of people trying, he did it by, you know, 0.6 seconds or something. Well, a week later, somebody else broke the record, broke his record. And a month later, somebody broke that record, and they kept breaking it and breaking it, and now the record is some 16, 17 seconds less. And it wasn't that evolution changed and we became gazelles. It's that people believed you could do it.
Yeah.
So they did it.
So rule 11, this is the tough one.
Do whatever is necessary?
Uh-huh.
Yes, well, that, you know, you have to have this thing we call will, and you also have to have some resources, some skills to get out of many kinds of these predicaments, whether they're in the wilderness or not. But having that determination to do just anything that's necessary to get it done is often what separates the survivors from those who don't survive, or the successful ones from those who don't succeed. And it often means doing things that are contrary. In Steve Callahan's case, when his boat sank, he believes it was rammed by a whale, but it happened very suddenly in the middle of the night. He found himself, his boat was upside down and sinking, and he was in the little life raft that he had inflated. And he's looking at the boat thinking, my survival pack is in there. You know, I'm going to die without that survival pack. That's the only thing I've got. And so he actually left his life raft, dove into the water, underwater, swam into the boat, risking his own life from drowning or getting trapped in there, and got the survival pack and brought it out. This is an incredibly bold thing to do in the middle of the night, in the middle of the ocean. But as I say, do whatever is necessary. And the same was true of many people in the World Trade Center. But the same is also true of many people in medical situations. You know, when you do something like have surgery and chemotherapy for cancer, you're doing something really drastic.
Right.
In an effort to save your own life.
Right, and I think part of this is why it's so important to go back to one of the earlier rules, to critically analyze your situation.
Right, yes. And this is true in business, too. The company Intel, famous chip maker Intel, was originally a company that made little memory chips. And the Japanese figured out how to make them, and they could make them way cheaper, and Intel was losing money hand over fist. And the guys who ran it, Gordon Moore and Andy Grove, said, gee, you know, we're going to die if we stay as a memory maker. What are we going to do? And they basically asked themselves, well, when the board of directors fires us, what will the new guys do? And they said, well, they'll get rid of memory chips and they'll start making microprocessors. So they did that. It was a wrenching, terrible experience. It cost them $800 million, I think it was, to do this. They had to close plants. They had to fire 8,000 employees. It was a terrible experience.
Right. It's horrible to have to destroy your own plan.
Right. And it destroyed their identity and their own plan and who the company was. But, you know, the result is today they're the most powerful chip maker in the world.
Right. And last but not least, never give up.
Yes, that is last but not least. Well, it's that time, you know, when you've tripped and fallen on your face just one more time, and you know you just can't get up, and you're lying there thinking, well, I'm breathing in and I'm breathing out, so there must be something I can do. And you do it. And as I say, this is true in all areas of life, but I mean, I have a story about this of my own, which is completely out of the wilderness realm at all. In 1994 or 95, I came up with an idea for a novel that I wanted to write. And I started working on it, and I couldn't, and I tried to write it as a short story and as a screenplay and as this and as that. And over the years, I kept going back to it, and it just, you know, the idea wouldn't let me alone, and yet I couldn't succeed at writing it well. And in 2007, my younger daughter, Amelia, was home from college, and I happened to tell her this idea that had been bugging me for so long. And she said, this is a fabulous idea. You have to keep going. And because of her encouragement, I kept going and actually finished the book and polished the book and made it decent. And the publishing company, Alfred A. Knopf, bought it, and it's coming out this coming spring.
Oh, what's the name?
It's called Lucy.
Lucy.
Lucy. Yes, and it plays out of a lot of the scientific research that I did writing deep survival and everyday survival. But it's a novel, and after all those years, you know, I just wouldn't quit. And thanks to the help of my daughters, in the end, wouldn't quit. But it was one of those things that if you'd asked me this 4 years ago, are you ever going to finish that book, I would have said, nah, it'll never happen. I've tried. You know, I've tried enough times. It's, you know what I mean? So you just never know.
There was one story in Deep Survival, and I can't remember the name of the person, but it was the survivor who lives through incredible efforts to get back down to base camp, and their friend is just leaving, and you literally sit on the edge of your chair thinking, oh, my God, are they going to, you know, is he going to get all this way? But that's a...
That was Joe Simpson. He had a book called Touching the Void, and it was made into a movie. And he's the guy who broke his leg at 20,000 feet on a mountain in Peru. It was 19,000, I think, actually.
Oh, wow. I didn't make the connection with Touching the Void.
Yes, it was Touching the Void. And he literally crawled down the mountain with a broken leg, and everything that could possibly happen to him, every bad thing happened to him on the way down. And he literally crawled into camp as his partner was packing things up to leave. The guy was burning his clothes, you know, and just crawled into camp, you know, by his fingernails. So that's an example of what I'm talking about. He could have easily died, but he just wouldn't give up.
It's funny.
It's sort of like the Terminator syndrome.
There's so much in the environment that denigrates the human race, you know, whether on TV or in the news. And I think when you read Deep Survival and the stories in Everyday Survival, you realize what an amazing people, you know, what an amazing species we are.
Yes.
And it makes you very proud to be a human. And you realize when you see the accomplishments of the people you introduce us to, how many people there are to inspire us.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. It's very inspirational. When I wrote Deep Survival, it was kind of like channeling some other voice. I'd often write things and I'd look at them and I'd think, who wrote that? Where did that come from? It's a very spiritual experience, right?
Uh-huh.
And I kind of felt that when the book was done, I looked back at it and thought, wow, how did I do that? Because it was so uplifting, not only to read it, but to write it. And I'm actually working on a book right now about the process of writing that uses a lot of this neuroscience to explain what happens when writing works and affects someone, as opposed to what happens when writing falls flat and doesn't work.
Well, I think for me the thing that has been so important about reading your work is it's very hard to, you know, the greatest learning comes to us through experience.
Yeah.
Because we experience it emotionally. And the thing that was so phenomenal about Deep Survival was you really are with these different people experiencing it emotionally, and it really changes, you know, you have an emotional experience yourself. And so in fact, we can get some of the benefits without having to go get lost in the wilderness.
Yes, and that's one of the essential mechanisms that causes good writing to work, is that the reader has the emotional experience that the writer's having.
Right.
So it's a form of emotional contagion.
Well, maybe, I want to thank you so much for doing this because I know how busy you are. Maybe if we could just take another minute and you could explain to people how to connect with your websites and keep up with your work, both through the website and through National Geographic.
Well, my main website is lawrencegonzalez.com. And I'm pretty easy to find through a Google search. There's deepsurvival.com as well, and there's everydaysurvival.net, but they're all linked together, so if you find one, you'll find them all. And then the new novel, Lucy, will have a website soon.
And when will Lucy be available?
It's coming out in the spring, so spring 2010.
Okay.
It's just going into proofs right now. But the National Geographic Adventure website is linked from my website, so people can find that there. And then there's also a calendar of my speaking engagements and appearances and that sort of thing. So all of that stuff is contained within that complex of websites.
Okay, well, it's been a...
You can link our website with your website.
We will. We'll have all the links up on the blog post.
Yeah.
Lawrence, it's just been a pleasure to read your books, to have the opportunity to talk with you, to have you join us for the Solari Report. And I just, you know, your work is just such a blessing to anybody that it touches, and I just want to thank you on behalf of all of us for it.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay, Lawrence Gonzalez. I said this in the blog post, but I want to encourage any viewer who are interested. I think that reading Deep Survival or listening to the or reading the 12 Rules of Survival, listening to this O'Leary Report, sharing it, you know, have a potluck dinner, talk about the book, talk about the Rules of Survival and how they might apply to helping us, whether it's with family, friends, neighbors over the next year. How can we help each other make it through and really navigate what is becoming increasingly difficult time? So if anything in this O'Leary Report can help you do that, I really encourage you to share it with those who you might gather to talk about these things, because I think Gonzalez's work is very, very relevant to all of our situations and all the things that everybody in these networks globally are dealing with. Anyway.